Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Chris Cherniak, and I'm here with John Wells. And our next guest is Robert Alboron, who is an astrophysicist here in Park City. Robert joins us to help us understand what space weather is, why it is so important, and how we can learn more about this fascinating subject. Robert Alboron, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It's happy to be here.
Well, okay, let's start here. Let's get some background. Space weather, this is a big difference between, say, our atmospheric, normal atmospheric weather?
Correct. So our solar system is essentially dominated by the sun, has about 99% of the mass of the solar system, and it's a beast of a star, and we live quite close to it. So we have to learn how to live with the energy given off by the sun and its interactions with Earth's magnetic field, and see how we can protect ourselves from major storms.
So with respect to the Earth's atmosphere, where does the Earth's weather end and space weather begin?
Correct. So here on the ground, we're breathing a neutral atmosphere, so that means these particles are not electrically charged. However, if we go up higher in altitude, to about 400 kilometers or so, we see these neutral particles stripped away from their electrons from the sun's radiation. So we have a photoionized layer called the ionosphere okay. of the Earth, and we get a lot of electrical currents fed in from the sun that couple with the currents, in fact, underneath our feet from about 400 to 800 kilometers in altitude. These currents will couple with the currents underground, and if they're very strong, they can overwhelm power stations and do some other damage.
Yeah, this is all fascinating. I spoke to somebody from NASA several years ago who told me about an extreme solar storm that had a powerful CME, the acronym is coronal mass ejection, that tore through the Earth's orbit. Now, the Earth wasn't there at the time. If it had been a week earlier, we probably would have been and may have taken the brunt of this eruption. And what he said to me was that a widespread power blackouts could have happened because we didn't have any early warning to be able to take our devices offline, and that many components in our electrical grid have transformers or have pieces of technology that take 2 years to build. So it could have been a Mad Max for a couple of years where we wouldn't have electricity or we wouldn't have communication satellites. So a couple of things. One is, if you could, one, comment on this incident, and two, what safeguards do we have that protect us from these types of things happening in the future?
Correct. So to understand these coronal mass ejections, we have to understand the sun. So these coronal mass ejections emit massive amounts of energy. They travel to the Earth in about three or four days, so we have a little bit of a head time to see these particles trapped in magnetic bubbles traveling through the inner solar system to the Earth. We get a little bit of a heads up. However, in 2012, a CME missed the Earth by about 9 days in its orbit. The damages that were estimated by Lloyd's of London and Atmospheric and Environmental Research in 2013 estimated the damages to be around $0.6 to $2.6 trillion in the U.S. alone. This is due to massive currents that are formed in the ionosphere. They couple with the currents underground, overwhelm the power stations. So that's a big big concern for us here, for modern civilization. Another aspect of space weather that we're very concerned about is spacecraft charging. So the number one cause of spacecraft failure, talking communication satellites, navigation satellites, is the accumulation of charge on the outside of these crafts that actually come from the sun. So let's say if you have a solar panel on an International Space Station, it's connected electrically to another component on the satellite. And let's say the solar panel gathers a lot of charge, it will have differential charging levels, you have arcs and discharges, and you can have system failure. So one, we're very concerned with space weather by the survivability of the spacecraft for our communications, for our navigation systems. Two, we're concerned about our power systems on Earth, and we don't want to, overwhelm our power systems because we can have massive blackouts, as you mentioned. And then three, another aspect that not many people think about is polar flights. So people that take airplane flights close to the south or north magnetic poles, there's a free stream area of these particles that can more readily enter down towards the surface of the Earth. So we're concerned with radiation sickness of passengers on flights as well.
And Robert, back to the International Space Station, I don't really understand this, but is it partially protected by this magnetosphere so that if the International Space Station were, let's say, halfway between here and Mars, it would be even more exposed? I mean, it's somewhat protected by being in our magnetosphere. So our concern is obviously for the International Space Station, but it's also for our spacecraft that will be traveling to distant planets and what their exposure might be compared to being close geographically, physically, to the Earth.
Correct. So the Earth's magnetosphere protects a lot of the solar wind that comes into us. So we have the sun on one side, the Earth on another side. The Earth has this nice magnetic bubble. The solar wind compresses the day side and expands it kind of in a teardrop in the night side. So we have this protection. If we look at Mars, for instance, it doesn't have an atmosphere. And that's because it all got blown away by the solar wind because it didn't have a magnetic barrier. So we're very lucky that here on the Earth we can have a healthy dynamo to produce a magnetic field, to protect our atmosphere, and so on and so forth. And as you alluded to, as we travel outside of this barrier, we're more subject to these energetic particles.
And explain a little bit more about solar wind. Is that literally something that is measured the same way that we measure, you know, wind here on Earth? Wind speed, or what is solar wind?
Correct. So to fully answer your question, let's talk a bit about the sun. So it formed about 4.6 billion years ago, and this was a collapse of a giant molecular cloud or a nebula. So we have this big cloud of dust and gas in space. It collapses due to gravity, and it compresses, starts snowballing, and starts flattening out into a disk, which is now the solar system. So the sun formed, it's about 109 times the diameter of the Earth, about 330,000 times the mass of the Earth. Mm-hmm. It fuses about 600 million tons of hydrogen into helium every second. So we know the Einstein mass-energy equivalence of E equals mc squared. So as you have a lot of mass, we also have a lot of energy. Mm. So in fact, the sun converts about 4 million tons of matter into energy every second. So this is what powers the sun. And on the surface of the star, we have a lot of magnetic loops coming in and out of these sunspots. Mm-hmm. And it's a very dynamic, active place. So we have this massive power coming out of the sun, and it's released in the form primarily of solar wind. So solar wind is essentially these particles, protons, electrons, alpha particles, which are two protons and two neutrons together, and they're flying out into space. And it permeates the entire solar system. In fact, we used to think that space was a vast emptiness of darkness. Mm-hmm. But now we know that we have all these high energetic particles coupled with the magnetic fields that are released from the sun. They travel through interplanetary space, and then it reaches the Earth. So these magnetic fields that are holding these particles, these magnetic bubbles, if you will, as they travel from the sun to the Earth, then they connect with the magnetic bubble of the Earth in a process called magnetic reconnection. And essentially, it slingshots all those energetic particles into the Earth system. So I'm talking about terawatt scale of power. So you get a ton of magnetic energetic particles. Mm-hmm. It slingshots into the Earth's poles. And we're looking at 10 to the 12 watts. So a trillion watt scale of these energies.
And is that every second, every hour?
Yeah.
What's the rate of that energy that's arriving at Earth?
Right. So the solar wind is constantly coming out. It travels about 450 miles per second. It's a supersonic flow. But these coronal mass ejections are more concerning.
Okay.
So these are the big storms that come out of the sun. So the solar wind's constant,
yes.
Relatively constant through the solar cycle. But these coronal mass ejections... those are the ones that we're really concerned about. And those travel to us, they get to us in about 4 or 5 days or so. And those are the big energetic solar storms that really influence us here on Earth.
Okay. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Robert Alboron. He's an astrophysicist. He lives here in Park City. We're talking about, among other things, space weather and coronal mass ejections. That's different than, say, sunspots.
It's very much related, yes. So,
but sunspots can play a big role in space weather, too.
Correct. So the sunspots give us an easy diagnosis of the activity of the sun.
Okay.
So the sun cycle, the solar cycle, goes in about 11 years. So we have some times of a lot of sunspots, a lot of activity, and then it kind of dims away into solar minimum, and it comes back and so forth. The entire magnetic field of the sun reconfigures in 22 years. So right now we are in solar cycle 24, going down into the minimum of solar activity, and the maximum was in about 2014. So that's when we had a lot of sunspots. So when we see a lot of sunspots towards the equator of the sun, it's, you know, more aligned towards the Earth, because the Earth is roughly in the sun's equator.
Right.
So when we see a lot of sunspots, we have a lot more magnetic activity. So what happens is these particles come out of these coronal holes and are have a fixed in magnetic field. So let's say, just like a big bubble that gets bursted off the sun, it will trap all these particles in the coronal mass ejection, travel to the Earth, and then it affects us here.
Okay.
And Chris, as you said, we're here talking about space weather, but Robert, as an astrophysicist, he can talk about a whole bunch of different things, okay. and we decided that we would talk about space weather today. But it's just great having you here, Robert, because it's like our personal astrophysicist here in Park City. Historically, back in the 1940s and the 1950s, up until then, people didn't think that there was much out there in space, that it was basically just space. And then this guy Parker was the one that made this controversial position that, hey, the space is teeming with particles, and there's X-rays and radioactive and all these gamma rays and everything else. And those all, and photons of light, those all travel at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. So if they left the sun, they'd get here in 7 minutes. But fortunately, this plasma you're talking about, these coronal mass ejections, they don't travel at the speed of light. These are these blobs of plasma, and they take 4 or 5 days to get here?
Correct. So these coronal mass ejections travel about 300 miles per second.
Okay.
So to travel the Earth-Sun distance, it takes roughly 3 to 4 days.
Okay.
So we have a little bit of preparation. In fact, a lot of people are concerned with these events. We have spacecraft closer to the sun that can give us a little bit of a warning when we see these massive coronal mass ejections come our way.
And do the countries of the Earth, are they prepared to take their grids offline, or to reposition satellites, or to move things around so that they are not getting hammered, and then they can bring the things back online?
Correct, yes. So, for instance, there's a center in Boulder, Colorado, that does a lot of space weather forecasting, and as they see a storm come, they do the proper precautions. They will notify large power stations, will notify polar flights, airlines, different communications navigation satellite systems to prepare for this big influx of energy.
Okay.
Is there a way to predict future CMEs? Can you look at the sun and say, oh, that looks like an area that's going to be prone to a CME?
Yes, absolutely. There's a ton of modeling efforts.
Okay.
In forecasting state-of-the-art supercomputer simulations that try to forecast these things, and also with different satellite observations, we combine the theoretical and observational tools to get a best idea of forecasting.
This is all fascinating. Back to Parker, the controversial gentleman who said that there's really a lot going on out there in space. His controversial position is now accepted by everyone, to the point that I think he's the first person that has had a spacecraft named after him, the Parker Solar Probe. And we had the engineer on that put together the instrumentation package that was going to be at 6,500 degrees Fahrenheit, protected by this foam core and graphite and graphene and all this stuff that would keep the instrumentation package at 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 75 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just fascinating. But the Parker Solar Probe, just an update, has now made its first pass going past the sun. It's going to get closer, but it's actually in the sun's corona now. And this is just fascinating to me because intuitively, and Chris, I don't know how you feel about this, but you would think that the center of the sun would be hotter than this coronal, this outside portion of the sun, but the corona is actually 300 times hotter. Why is that?
Yeah, that's due to just the energetics. So the sun, so in the core we have the fusion, right? Like I was saying, and this energy from the thermonuclear fusion takes about 10,000 to 170,000 years to escape the core. So some of these particles, they take even millions of years to go from the center of the sun to the surface. And at the surface, of course, we have different points of temperature variations, essentially. So we look at the magnetic activity of the sun, and it's not just a normal bar magnet, as we might think of it as. Mm. It's, in fact, very, very tangled up. It has all these magnetic knots. So there are points in the star's surface where there are cooler areas, there are hotter areas. We have these magnetic loops that will loop out of the surface of the star, come back in, bring in, have these little particles race around the magnetic field lines, just like race cars on a racetrack. So the star is a very dynamic place. It's always changing. The whole pole reversal of the star, of the magnetic field, takes about 22 years. So that delineates the activity of solar max, solar minimum, with more activity in solar max of sunspots towards the equator, and solar minimum, they kind of go towards the poles. And throughout the entire solar cycle, in fact, we see a large influence here on Earth. So for instance, when we look at a lot of solar spots, sunspots, we can kind of diagnose to see if there's more solar activity. But I guess the best example here is perhaps the largest solar storm ever recorded. This was in 1859,
right.
The so-called Carrington event. Mm-hmm. And this was a time where the sun gave off, in fact, two coronal mass ejections, one right behind the other. So the first one kind of plowed through the solar wind and made a big opening for the second coronal mass ejection to arrive. And in fact, it arrived quite fast, in about a couple days or so, 1 or 2 days. So this Carrington event, in fact, it was recorded to have seen the aurora borealis, or the northern lights, very close to the equator. Southern Mexico, southern Japan, China, Cuba, the Caribbean, Hawaii, even as south as Colombia. So to see the northern lights in Colombia, that's a major, major solar storm.
Didn't the telegraph poles catch on fire or something?
Correct, yes. So as I mentioned, space and Earth are very much interconnected. We have these strong currents in the ionosphere, 400 to 800 kilometers in altitude, powered by the sun. These electrical currents will couple with the currents underground. So with the telegraph, they would disconnect their machines from the battery, but there was so much latent current underground that they can still submit messages and get from Boston to Maine and send telegraphs without any battery supply. So that was something that was very, very large. Today, if that event happened and it hit us, we're looking at about $3 trillion in U.S. Damages in the U.S. alone. So these are major, major events.
Not to mention Mad Max. I mean, I can only imagine what would happen if our grid got knocked out, Chris. What do you think?
Well, it would certainly have an influence on our show. Well, first and foremost.
That's right.
So is there any way of predicting that that might occur again? Does that occur with any set frequency?
Yeah. So, in fact, these sort of things happen all the time. During solar max, there are about 3 coronal mass ejections per day. So 3 of these massive storms come out per day in solar minimum. It's about 1 CME every 5 days. So these are something that we live with all the time. And of course, it depends on the position of the Earth in its orbit to see if these storms actually arrive and hit us or not. But yeah, I mean, 3 coronal mass ejections a day in solar max, it's kind of a ubiquitous phenomena here.
So does that CMEs like that, do they actually affect our weather here in any way? Does it change jet streams or weather patterns, right? Or is this strictly an electrical phenomenon?
It couples with everything.
Okay.
Yes. So I guess a basic example to say is the creation of wind. So the reason we have wind is because of the friction of neutral particles in our atmosphere with the ionosphere. So we have this electrical current 400 kilometers in altitude. A little bit below that, we have more neutral particles. And these two populations of particles, the charges and the non-charges, will kind of rub up against each other, cause friction, and that's our wind. So, of course, as we get these variations in the ionosphere, in the magnetosphere, it very much couples with tropospherical weather and weather closer down to the ground.
Okay. All linked. Thank you very much. Robert Aberon. He's an astrophysicist, lives here in Park City. Do you have a website or so people can go learn more about what you do? Or?
Yeah, sure. I'll have to update it, but I could send it over your way. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. We'll try to post it on our station website.
A couple of things. One is traffic is still backed up on both entrances into Park City. Here's an idea. Exit at Jeremy and park in Ecker Park and ride by taking the bus into Park City. We also would like to thank our sponsors this morning. Nexus IT, San Francisco Design, Habitat for Humanity Restore, Natural History Museum of Utah, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We have just a couple more underwriters. Stay with us. We'll return with some final words. Robert, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Okay.